Well, to say 2020 has been a rough year for our world is a bit of an understatement, but a short video by a New Zealand-born poet has brought a message of hope to millions who've seen it. Thomas Roberts is also known as Tom Foolery, and his The Great Realisation has had a great resonance around the world, with 60 million views since it was first posted. It's now been turned into a book, beautifully illustrated by the Japanese artist Namoko. If you haven't seen the original video of Thomas reading, we've embedded it on our webpage. Let's listen in.
Tell me the one about the virus again, then I'll go to bed.
But my boy, you're growing weary, sleepy thoughts about your head.
Please, that one's my favourite. I promise just once more.
Okay. Snuggle down, my boy, though I know you know full well. The story starts before then, in a world I once would dwell. It was a world of waste and wonder, of poverty and plenty, back before we understood why hindsight's 2020. You see, the people came up with companies to trade across all lands, but they swelled and got much bigger than we ever could have planned. We'd always had our wants, but now it got so quick. You could have anything you dreamed of in a day, and with a click. We noticed families had stopped talking. That's not to say they never spoke, but the meaning must have melted, and the work-life balance broke. And the children's eyes grew squarer, and every toddler had a phone. They filtered out the imperfections, but amidst the noise, they felt alone. And every day the skies grew thicker, till you couldn't see the stars. So we flew in planes to find them, while down below, we filled our cars. We'd drive around all day in circles. We'd forgotten how to run. We swapped the grass for tarmac, shrunk the parks till there were none. We filled the sea with plastic, because our waste was never capped. Until each day when you went fishing, you'd pull them out, already wrapped. And while we drank and smoked and gambled, our leaders taught us why. It's best to not upset the lobbies. More convenient to die. But then in 2020, a new virus came our way. The governments reacted and told us all to hide away. But while we all were hidden, amidst the fear and all the while, the people dusted off their instincts. They remembered how to smile. They started clapping to say thank you and calling up their mums. And while the car keys gathered dust, they would look forward to their runs. And with the skies less full of voyagers, the earth began to breathe. And the beaches bore new wildlife that scuttled off into the seas. Some people started dancing. Some were singing. Some were baking. We'd grown so used to bad news, but some good news was in the making. And so when we found the cure, and were allowed to go outside, we all preferred the world we found to the one we'd left behind. Old habits became extinct, and they made way for the new, and every simple act of kindness was now given its due.
But why did it take a virus to bring the people back together?
Well, sometimes you've got to get sick, my boy, before you start feeling better. Now lie down and dream of tomorrow, and all the things that we can do. And who knows, if you dream hard enough, maybe some of them will come true. We now call it the Great Realisation. And yes, since then there have been many. But that's the story of how it started, and why hindsight's 2020.
That's our guest, Thomas Roberts, who is based in London. Tom, hi. Lovely to talk to you.
Kia ora, Catherine. Hello. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. I almost was drifting off in the best possible way listening to that. Very soothing, very calming. Did it come very quickly and very simply to you? What was the context in which you penned this?
Oh, well, the... So as broadly as I can explain it, it was a very strange time for everybody. My particular situation was I'd been living with I'd been living with friends, and my source of income, my work, was I was making videos for the social media accounts of big companies, and as a freelancer. And so when lockdown began, my source of income vanished, and so I had to move back in to my dad's house, where I have a 7-year-old brother and sister. My dad was working in the health service, so I suddenly had gone from this lifestyle of being a 26-year-old and being with my friends and working and feeling, you know, like an active member of society, so suddenly unemployed, back at home, playing big brother. And it was very strange. And, you know, I really didn't want to feel like I wasn't contributing, particularly because my mum, my dad, my big sister all work in health. And I was the one that wanted to be a filmmaker or a poet or an actor or any of these, you know, artsy, creative things. And so when we found ourselves in this situation, and I found myself having to explain to these two 7-year-olds what was going on, and, you know, every night I'd read them a bedtime story, I decided to start creating these little projects that we could do together as a way of passing the time, and also as a way of, I suppose, spreading a little bit of hope and optimism, which I thought, you know, people really could do with.
And so what happens when you launch this to the world? Because you do a number of these little videos, right? I'm just curious as to how things unfolded. I know you launched your YouTube platform right when we were going into lockdown, actually 22nd March. But what happened? Were you beginning to release some work, or did you work particularly on this one piece? How did things kick off?
Well, I tried to put the same amount of care and attention into each of the pieces. The piece, The Great Realization, that you just played on your show, that was the fourth piece, that was the fourth video that we released in lockdown. And I suppose, you know, the first three, when I look back at them in their own way, they were very rough in so many ways, you know, because firstly, in terms of subject matter, we were just acclimatizing to what was going on around us and what was unfolding. And also, I was, you know, I'm used to being on film sets where there's a person behind the camera, a person doing the sound, a person doing the lights, person acting, you know, all of these. And suddenly I was kind of attempting to do all of these jobs at once. And it's, you know, it's quite fiddly and it's quite time consuming and difficult. So the first three were quite rough. But by the time we got to the fourth, I felt really comfortable in the making of them. And so I think I was able to invest more thought into the message and more thought into what I wanted to say. And so, you know, spent the time thinking about really about what I wanted to write about. And the phrase that sparked the imagination for this one, I suppose, was this phrase that I kept hearing coming out of so many mouths, including my own, which was people saying, I can't wait for things to go back to normal. And, you know, for some reason, this just played on my mind. And I suppose it's because, you know, I felt like maybe we were selling ourselves short. You know, this moment is so difficult and it's so disruptive that, you know, I think it's been a great opportunity for a lot of people to, you know, take stock of the world around them, to reevaluate things in their lives and imbalances, maybe that wouldn't have been examined without this disruptive moment. And I think it's taken so many people out of this you know, this hamster wheel that we've been running on collectively. I know it did for me, at least. I found that I was spending more time with my family, and I was starting to understand, you know, my little brother and sister in a different way, which I thought was pretty cool. I was eating better, I was drinking less, exercising more. And so, yeah, and it's not to negate any of the suffering of this time. You know, I think there's much to be said for people who are, you know, people who have lost loved ones or their jobs. You know, I lost my job in this time effectively. But also I think we we found many things and we realised many things. And so I was trying to celebrate that.
Yeah. I think that's the genius of it, is that without lecturing, it posits exactly the pivot point to which you refer. We all know nothing's going to be the same again. There's an understanding desire for people to have back things that they value or that support their lives or that protect them. But in our heart of hearts, we know nothing is ever going to be the same again. And the question is what we do with that. And it's a lovely way to reflect through the eyes of a child the best outcome of what we're going through.
Yeah, well, I think I don't think people need, you know, I don't think people need much to be hopeful for in order to be incredibly resilient in a difficult time. But I think people need something to look forward to. You know, I know that I do in my life. I have goals and I have aims and I have aspirations. And when you find yourself, you know, without those things, and if you begin to believe the idea that things aren't going to get better, I think that that's a really poisonous idea, actually. And I think that you know, coronavirus, COVID-19 has, you know, a certain group of physical afflictions that it divvies out. But I think it's for years, you know, we're going to see the mental impact, or the impact on people's mental health that this time has caused. And so, you know, while we've got our brightest and best scientific minds treating people in the hospitals like the rest of my family were, which I'm really proud of, I think it falls on the artists in our society, you know, the musicians and the singers and the dancers and the poets, you know, to try and provide some nurture for people's mental health.
It's nurture, and it's more than that, which I think is the genius of this particular piece. Because it is looking back in hindsight, and because it is talking about a world that realised a lot of things about what had gone wrong, and recaptured things that had been lost, there's a wonderful optimism to it. It's literally provides a vision. But I want to talk a little bit more about it stylistically, because it's that comfort of the rhymes most of us were fortunate enough to hear as children. We might have had lullabies, we might have had stories, and we might have had a particular kind of rhyme. And that just innately sort of touches something primal in adults as much as children, doesn't it? Were you surprised by 60 million and counting people obviously clicking and sharing and enjoying this, and now it becoming a book? What was it about the style of what you produced that has so resonated?
I mean, I've got to say, I truly was surprised. I still am surprised. I think I feel incredibly lucky to have a piece of work, you know, that I spent time creating, be, you know, appreciated by so many people. And I think actually that's the wrong word. I think was useful to people, I think is closer to being the right descriptive word, because, you know, I think whether you're a songwriter or a poet or any means of expressing yourself and expressing ideas and telling stories, I think if you can feel like a feeling that you tried to encapsulate and then share with people was useful to even a few people, but in this instance of an overwhelming amount of people, then I think it's really humbling. And you're right, you know, poetry, and I know often I've done many shows around London where they, you know, there'll be musicians or singers, and then they say, next up to the stage, we've got a poet. And you see people's eyes roll in the crowd because they think, oh, you know, I'm gonna have someone bearing their soul, or I'm gonna have some Shakespeare. And I know in the mainstream, it's not considered as many people's cup of tea as maybe pop music, but it's got the same roots, you know. It's playing with words and with stories and similar sounds, and I think that runs deep with people.
I've seen a PDF of the book. One of the great challenges at the moment, Tom, as I'm sure you know, is all the books are arriving late because of delays in supply chains and stuff. But I've been able to see a PDF of this beautifully illustrated book that it's now become. And how did all this happen? Were you approached by a publisher? And how did you find this wonderful artist?
Oh my goodness, she is absolutely wonderful. Her name is Nomoko, and she's a Japanese illustrator. And she was recommended to me by the publisher. So when I teamed up with HarperCollins, Egmont in the UK and HarperCollins in New Zealand, Australia, and the US, when I teamed up with them, they said, listen, here's a selection of illustrators who are available to start on this project right away and who, you know, would like to. And, you know, do you think that any of their styles would be right for this story? And I just absolutely fell in love with her work. Also, it's really nice because my little brother and sister who are in the video, they're half Japanese. We have the same dad, but we have a different mum, and their mum is from Tokyo, and so is Nomoko. So it felt, you know, really kind of meaningful to have, you know, these two cultures involved in telling this story. You know, I was able to contribute the words, and she was able to tell the story through colours and through imagery.
Children also experience big events, be they national events or international events, so differently. Parts of it more acutely than adults, other parts they understand less and might interpret differently. But what we cannot do is underestimate the effect. Mm. And they feel off us as well. They pick it up off us as well. So the idea of children's literature and of rhyme and music helping them understand and explore, is that on your mind too? And lovely again to be able to do this by looking back after things got better and we learned things. But are you very much on your mind that children need all the support that artists and writers and everyone else can give them in navigating what we're all experiencing?
Yeah, well, I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, firstly, I mean, they're next, aren't they? You know, so all of us who are working right now, it's to try, hopefully, you know, if like me, you believe that, you know, the vast majority of people are well-intentioned, hopefully we're going to try and, you know, build something better than was the case when we arrived. And I think, you know, that's what we tried to do. I think they're incredibly, I don't know, my little brother and sister are 7, and it's quite a cool age, I think, because you're old enough to ask questions and to and sometimes those questions really like cut to the core of the issue. You know, I remember really vividly, I was before lockdown, about 6 months ago, I was walking. I'd taken my little brother and sister out for the day into central London, and it was very exciting. And we were walking under a bridge, and there was this homeless man. And my little sister, she asked me, "Why can nobody see him?" And that was like a crushing question to ask, because obviously, from her perspective, these people weren't able to see this guy, because if they could, there was no reason why, you know, people would just walk by without even looking. And obviously then you're in the predicament where you think, okay, how can I explain to this, you know, innocent little 7-year-old, you know, there's factors at play here. We've got a system which isn't providing help for a person in that situation, and these individuals walking past think that their pound isn't going to be enough. And, you know, it's really forces you to think. And this is what happened to me in lockdown. You know, I was while the rest of my family were in the hospitals, I was spending the day with two inquisitive little 7-year-olds who were asking me all kinds of questions all day about what's going on. And I was doing the best I could to answer them.
Of course, they've been at home from school for months, the children, haven't they? Just recently gone back to school. So you really were making as much a contribution as anyone else. I know, I think your dad's an epidemiologist, isn't he? Which is kind of the career of the moment, and was called back to the NHS as well as others. But someone's got to be not just looking after the children, but nurturing and protecting their experience of this particularly unique situation. So it all landed, didn't it? It all landed in many ways. And you approach different problems of our times, though, different challenges of our times. And I want to talk about another piece that we're going to play a little bit of. And I'll get you just to explain this one. Can we just help me with the title of the next piece of Tom's that we're going to play so that he can explain what's happening? Tale of Two Mindsets. And you are playing two characters in this particular piece of spoken performance. And could you just set the scene for us before we hear a little of it so that people can hear some more of your work and how you go about tackling things, Tom? What's happening in A Tale of Two Mindsets?
Oh, well, thank you. It was the piece that I wrote and released immediately after The Great Realization. So it was the next piece of work that I did after that, and it's a battle between two opposing mindsets that I think are within us all. You know, optimism and pessimism, and they're having it out over a Zoom call, which I thought was, you know, really appropriate considering, you know, we're all spending so much of our lives on Zoom these days, or at least we were in that time.
We'll bring in a little through. Apologies for this, Tom, but we'll bring in a little bit into the piece and through to the end.
You know, some people are dying and babies are born. Some people go hungry, less than ever before. There are serial killers. Yeah, we came up with laws, propaganda, deception, and those who fight for a cause. What about abuses of power and tyrannical leaders? But don't you think the world has far more nurses and teachers who are paid next to nothing? Which I agree is disgusting.
Okay, so now who's pessimistic?
No, I can be realistic. Okay, so what are you saying? The people who work for nothing are senseless? No, I'm saying potentially some people are selfless. Some people are addicts. Some people get clean. Sometimes we have nightmares. Yes, and sometimes we dream.
Oh, enough!
Stop it, you are doing my head in. Go live in your fairy tale, but good luck forgetting the homelessness, poverty, disease, starvation, mistreatment of children, hunger, temptation, abuse in all forms, misuse of creation, abuses of power, eternal damnation.
I know!
Don't you think I know? Okay, what do you want me to say? I don't celebrate people's suffering and say hip hip hooray. We could be so much better if only we could, amidst all the bad, start to work for the good. Obsessing on the evils won't help in any way. But if we strive for improvement, then the evils can fade. Pull together. Be loving. Be wiser. Be kind. Stop for a moment. Relax and unwind. And slowly, yes, slowly, you'll see as we work ever more that the suffering is just less than you remember before. Look, I'm not being naive to suggest that the future could be bright, but I'd rather be an optimist proved wrong than a pessimist proved right.
Our guest, Thomas Roberts, again, performing A Tale of Two Mindsets there. It is such a potent form of art, spoken word, when it comes to confronting truths. There's no sort of glossing or hiding. You know, sometimes you listen to a song and you just don't hear the lyric, or you actually read the lyric and you think, oh my God, that's not at all what I thought it was about. Spoken word and the performance that comes with us creates emotion, and really there's nowhere to hide from it. Again, with this one, it's self-explanatory in a way, but again, is it not only the individual, is it a time where we all just seem to be quite extreme in our feelings about things, and quite prone, actually, to being on the downside of things rather than remembering so much of the good that goes on in our lives still?
I mean, definitely, you know. When The Great Realization came out, I got to do many, many interviews, and the question that was asked to me most frequently was, so are you an optimist? And, you know, I found I found this question to be misleading because I thought, you know, we're all both, you know, everyone is both, and we exist on a moment by moment basis on this sliding scale. And, you know, it's evident that some people, you know, spend more time in different parts of that scale. And I truly believe that it takes more energy to be optimistic. I think it's harder to try and see the potential in the world, but I think the payoff is that, you know, that's the reward is that you get to, you know, you get to live a life that I think feels like one that you want to be living. And so I'm so impressed by people who I meet that seem to be these eternal optimists, because I just think, wow, you know, you're working hard. And for people who are struggling to find the joy in life, I feel compelled to try and, you know, to try and offer any silver linings that I might be able to see. And then I also hope that when I'm struggling to see them, someone else will perform that role for me, you know. And I think it's almost a self-fulfilling prophecy, if you know what I mean. I feel like if you believe that things aren't going to get better, I think that the world will support that belief. You know, the world that you see will support that belief. And I think if you believe that actually, you know, you have a responsibility to yourself and to your family and to your community and to your country and to your world, and, you know, if you enact that responsibility and, you know, try and make things around you better and try and improve the lives of the people around you, I think, you know, if enough people were doing that all at the same time, I think things would get so much better so quickly that we wouldn't even recognize the world months ago before this virus.
Yeah, the other thing that's interesting is here we are talking about your family working in the health service, and you look at what the NHS has achieved, what our health system has achieved here in New Zealand. You see the incredible advance. I mean, the 1918-1919 influenza epidemic, millions died. Go back to the days of the plague, you know, and all you could do really was bring the bodies out, bring out your dead. And we need to remind ourselves again that for all that we are getting wrong, in part because of our cleverness, we're looking at climate change impacts, or the fact we travel so much, or the fact we have moved so much into the natural world that we are putting ourselves at risk of more and more pathogens like this being released. You can focus on that, or you can look and say, look how incredibly organised and cooperative our health systems have been. Efforts made by governments and central banks to try and stop a Great Depression emerging out of this, and to instead collectively support financially and put safety nets in. You've got to stop and remind yourself of the good things about our societies and where we've got to as a species, as well as the things that have created really serious problems.
Well, you know, this is what you've just described. This is why I you know, attempted to just look at this in the Tale of Two Mindsets poem. And, you know, I didn't want to just straw man the side of the conversation that was pessimism. I didn't want to make that just so clearly unimportant and undesirable, and then just destroy it with optimism, because I think we need both. We need to look at the world and be grateful for the things, for the advances we've made and the things that are available to us. We also need to look at the world and be critical and think of, you know, how we can improve things. And this was a really important message for me, I guess, because I didn't want, after the great realization, people to think, you know, is this kid just naive? Is he just living this, you know, incredibly blessed life and, you know, wandering around with his head in the clouds trying to tell us all it's all for the best? And I was thinking, no, you know, there's clearly some, you know, some great threats that that are facing us and that we need to take incredibly seriously. But whilst doing that, if you spend too much time in that headspace, I think, without exactly as you just said, looking at how far we've come in the last even 100 years, since the influenza outbreak, then I think you'll never feel that feeling of accomplishment or satisfaction in all the good things that are available to us.
I think just before 2020 did its thing, you were already doing some performance, and just tell us a little of where you'd got to in terms of performance art at that time.
Well, I was desperate to become a filmmaker, and so when I left university, I set up a film production company with two of the guys I went to university with, and then we've been making our first feature film for the last 3 years, and I was producing that piece of work. It was called Hilda, which is the story of a dancer in South London whose parents leave, and she has to drop out of school and try and raise her siblings and take control even at a very young age. And we put our blood, sweat and tears into creating that film, and we finally got this mammoth of a task completed, and this first project under our belts, and we were just about to show the film in its first festival. We'd gotten it into the Moscow International Film Festival, and then the world closed, and I think, I wasn't the only person in that situation. There were millions of people in similar situations. We were all in similar situations of having just such ultimate disruption. And I think, I still have, high hopes that we'll be able to find a home for that piece of work. But I also think, you've really got to be kind of acceptant of the circumstances that are available to you and that have presented themselves to you. And in this moment, there was nothing that could be done in that respect. And so, I started going back to my roots and making little films out of little films out of nothing that were 2 or 3 minutes long that we could just put on social media and see what happened. And, now I get to speak to you, which is amazing. And I get to talk about this wonderful book that has been created, which, none of these things could have been planned, but it's such a great like signpost of what can happen, I think, if you're just open to reacting to what's around you. So I feel very lucky.
What's wonderful, Tom. I have to ask, where's the hometown? Where were you born, down under?
I was born in Auckland.
Ah.
I was born in Auckland, and then when I was 18, I came back to live for a year, and I drove around really a lot of New Zealand, but I spent most of my time in Queenstown.
They'll be very glad to have you back as soon as it's allowed. That's for sure.
Oh, I've got my little black passport, and I intend to come back one day.
Wonderful stuff. Thanks for your time. Thomas Roberts, also known as Tom Foolery, and the book to accompany his video, which has had 60 million views, the video's on our webpage. The book is called The Great Realisation by Thomas Roberts, with art by Nomoko, and it is published by HarperCollins Children's Books.